Let's talk. John Brown.
Street Fighter, a fascinating new book by David McAlane. It's a life which has been an adventure from early years in a caravan to what looks like a life well lived, but in terms fascinating and in some cases downright frightening. Delighted to say that I'm joined live on the line by the author of Street Fighter, David McAlane. David, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Explain a little bit. I mean, we're going to talk about you in the book itself, but explain a little bit about your life thus far, who you are and why you decided the time was right to write the book.
Well, the time was right because I'm at the end of the towards the end of the rainbow. So, you know, now is a good time to do it while I'm still here. But the encouragement came from family and some friends, but particularly the children. Because, you know, I've always been someone who's told stories about the way I've lived.
Yeah.
And I've told the children, you know, on many times some of the situations I've been in. And they said, oh, you must put this down. So we've got it we've got a record of it. And that was the sort of raison d'être for doing it. And then, of course, you know, once I got into it, I thoroughly enjoyed doing it, frankly.
I mean, it's a life that starts, according to the press notes, that starts in a caravan. So, I mean, were your parents on a camping holiday somewhere, or are we talking something entirely different?
No, it was. You have to remember the time. It was just after the Second World War, which you won't remember, and a lot of other people won't. But times were tough. My mother was Jewish. She was a refugee from the Holocaust. Her parents died in a concentration camp. My father was an Irishman who came over to avoid starvation in Ireland, working during the war on aeroplanes. And he was a very practical man. And they bought this, or they rented this caravan, actually, next to a petrol station near Ilkeston in Derbyshire. And I was brought up there for 4 years, I suppose, until we moved into a council house, and it kind of took off from there.
And the schooling, where did you go? I mean, how did you? What was your education like? Because obviously, this is if you like from these humble beginnings.
The parents did their absolute damnedest for all of us. I was one of three siblings, and they, you know, I had a really good childhood. Considering the sort of lack of money and lack of resources, father started his own business in sort of after the war. The Irish were particularly good. That whole diaspora of Irish were particularly good at civil engineering. And he bought a couple of ex-war department Caterpillar tractors, which I was fascinated with right from being very young. And he hired these out to, you know, Wimpy, Taylor Woodrow, all these sort of people, and built his business up from that. And, of course, being fascinated with these machines, it kind of gelled with me. They did quite well with this. There was a particular Irishman who did very well his name was Huey Murphy, the Murphy brothers of Leicester.
Right.
And Huey became a bit of a mentor for me. The Irish tended to look after each other and at that time particularly, and I was very grateful for it. I mean, I had a good education, actually. I went to private school. I didn't enjoy it.
Right.
I didn't do well at it. I couldn't wait to leave. But I went to Giggleswick in North Yorkshire for the secondary education, where my tutor was housemaster was Russell Harty, who was famous later for his
hosting TV show, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, show his talk shows and what have you, and being attacked by Rod Hull and the Emu and Grace Jones,
but not at the same time. That would have been good fun
But the story I had about Russell Harty was, I mean, I didn't enjoy school, and there's quite a bit in the book about that. And as I was leaving school, right at the end, when we were shaking hands, everybody with the teachers and what have you, and he shook hands with me, he said, "McElhane, I've got no idea what you're going to do with your life." And I shook hands with him. I said, "Sir, I'm going to earn enough money to buy this school and flatten it."
Fair enough. And,
it became, you know, anyway, I actually got a call years later from, apparently it was at school when I was there, but I don't remember him. And he was chairman of the, what you call it, the alumni.
Yeah.
And he said, "David, you know, I see you've done quite well in life. You've made a few bob, right, and the school needs some money. I know what you said about buying it and flattening it, because it became a bit of folklore there. But I just wonder whether you'd like to just reconsider that and give us some money." And I sent him a quick email back saying, "Dear," I'll not mention his name,
"sure,
thank you for your email. No. Best wishes, David."
Fair enough. So did you go into the family firm then? Did you get involved? Was that where you, if you like, your business?
Yes, brand? I got involved with the family business, which was not doing terribly well by the late 60s, early 70s. But I only did a year there. After I went to university at Durham Business School, where I did a master's degree, which really meant something then, you know. I mean, lots of people get master's degrees now because they go and get a job, which is a pity. But I started work for him, realised it wasn't going to work. You know, I was much more ambitious, a very ambitious character. So
I mean,
I wanted to start.
The book's called Street Fighter. I mean, is it? Is that the bit you like about business? The not the confrontation aspect, but you see, is it the cutting the deal, or the is that what sort of was driving you back then and still drives you today?
Oh, Giles, it's all of that. I mean, you have to Street Fighter. The name came to me, and I discussed it with my children about it, and. It came to me because it is a battle. I mean, it's different if you've got loads of money behind you, but mine was always a struggle. I had a very good mentor, originally with Huey, but mainly with a chap called Dennis Bell and another Derbyshire man who lent me the equivalent of £1 million, £70,000 cash and a £20,000 guarantee on the overdraft. And that got me started in the open cast business on my own. From there, it blossomed. And in the open cast industry, which was full of guys who were, you know, they sort of wore three-piece suits in tweeds, and they drove around. They had drivers to drive them round. And there was I in my jeans, yep, and my Range Rover, out on site at 6 o'clock with the machines when the men went for tea or the tea break. I'd be dieseling the machines up, you know, like this, to make sure that we've got everything. And it all went, it really went very well, so much so that another chap helped me as well, Dennis Lean, who sold me some machines I need, some Caterpillar earth moving machines. And when I went to, he was the brother of David Lean, the film director.
Oh, right. Blue Velvet. David Lean. He did Lawrence of Arabia. Sorry, yeah, excuse me.
Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah, and Dennis Dennis Lean. Both Dennis's. Dennis Lean was a great help, because I agreed to buy these machines for £100,000 in 75, 76, something like that. And he said, "How are you going to pay for them?" I said, "Well, I'm going to use Forward Trust, which was the finance arm of Midland Bank." He said, "Well, they're going to charge you a fortune." I said, "Well, you know, I'm making enough money with the coal to be able to do it." Now, I said, "I'll tell you what, take the machines, give me £100,000 back in 18 months.
Wow. Okay.
I said, "Well, do you want me to sign up for something like that?" "No," he said, "no, just do it."
Here's the
it's
thing.
The same as, it was very good. In fact, I made the money back much quicker than 18 months, and I went back to pay him, and he said, "You're not going to look for a discount on it now because you're paying early." I said, "Absolutely not."
Here's the thing that just struck me. You know, you said how all the other, you know, previously in the business, they were all being driven around in their tweeds or whatever. I mean, you had this love of the machinery, you know, basically.
Yes.
From being, and that's sort of like, so if you know the nuts and bolts and you also know how the guy who is driving or operating the machinery feels, therefore you've got a much better, you understand the business on a sort of, you know, on a guttural level kind of thing, because you know how it works rather than being, you know, oh, the chaps are over there, you know, God bless the chaps. And you know, you haven't got airs and graces. You know what it's like. You're happy to get stuck in and refuel and think, okay, that needs changing and whatever. And that gives you an advantage at a time when other people are just saying, oh, well, you know, my club will be open in fire. You know, I've got to go up to Derbyshire, you know, that sort of thing.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, actually, Giles, with that. I mean, I always used to pay... It's a rule I've had right through my business life. Always pay 5% more than the proper rate. You probably like that in your job. 5% more than the...
When do I start, David?
And people will love you, you know?
Yeah.
Make sure you're always at the top of the ladder on the payment. And if the job won't stand it, if the profit won't stand it, maybe you got something wrong with your model. Mm. But and I've always had... You know, I moved on from coal to oil and gas,
yeah,
and what have you, and I did the same there. So I always got the best possible people.
Here's the thing. I mean, you talk about oil and gas. That took you to presumably the Middle East, and that's where, because it's a great story, but it's also tinged with tragedy and danger as well. The situation in Syria, which must have been, you know, which was sounds absolutely, you know, horrendous.
Well, that happened in the mid-70s when I was actually buying lots of Caterpillar equipment. In fact, I think I was the biggest buyer of Caterpillar equipment in Europe for about 2 years running. And it was the time of one of the big petrol crises, the first big petrol crisis, so crude oil prices and petrol and diesel prices. And the demand from the Middle East for Caterpillar equipment was much greater than Caterpillar could supply. So what I got orders placed with Caterpillar, stuff coming in regularly, new kit, and I was moving the old stuff out. The idea being, I'll rely on the warranty. I don't need the big workshop. I never had a workshop, actually, even with this massive Caterpillar fleet that we had. And I'd move it on to the Middle East, so we're doing well. And then one day... I got a friend in France who said that I'd done a lot of business with, and he said, look, we've got this deal to sell Land Rovers, new Land Rovers, to the Middle East, if you can get them. Well, we were quite big Land Rover customers because they were the ideal vehicle on all the open cast sites.
Of course, yeah.
So I spoke to Land Rover, and we got an allocation of left-hand drive, Middle East spec, into pig coolers and that. And so I bought them and had a lot of money in them. At the time, it was, I think I had something like £150,000 profit on these Land Rovers, which then was a hell of a lot of money, you know, probably five times now. And we put the Land Rovers on the boat in Southampton. And it stopped at Marseille on the way, apparently. I got the bill of lading signed, which is the important thing. So I went back to Barclays and got paid. And the ship arrived in Latakia in Syria, and it was one Land Rover short.
Uh-huh.
Or at least that's I don't know whether it was one short or whether it was a fiddle on the dockside in Latakia. And they refused to pay for any of them. So Barclays said, "Ooh, we like our money back. Sorry, Barclays, you know, you can't have it back because I've done my bit,
yeah,
and you've done your bit, etc." So, but stupidly, on reflection, I was keen on seeing what had happened. So I went with my friend out to Syria, and this is in the prologue of the book, which you may know about, and... We arrived in Latakia, went to see the forwarding agent there, the receiving agent, sorry, and they said, look, we know about this. We suggest you get in your car and leave immediately.
Right.
Get out of here. You shouldn't be asking these sort of questions. I mean, there's a bit of a sort of conversation about it, and then we got in the car and drove off. It was a Mercedes rental car on the way back to Beirut. On the way, I don't remember too many of the details. I kind of pushed it back to the back of my mind for until I wrote this book, actually. But we were stopped on the way with a sort of ambush, and we were forced out of the car. We were stood against a wall, and these guys were, they got machine guns and pistols and all sorts of things, and they opened fire against my friend and shot him dead. And I thought, that's my, it's me next. And they opened the boot of the car, they shoved the body in and said to me, go, drive. So, and I drove off. I mean, that was a big test of the sort of, I'm sure I probably had organ failure somewhere along the line there, but I drove, and I don't remember too much about it except that I was in a state of complete shock. I know at the end of it all, when I got back to the UK, I remember thinking, if I can get away with that, I can get away with anything.
Did you have, sorry, this is going to start, did you have the body in the boot of your car? They put the body in the...
Yes.
Sweet, in the
boot of the rental Mercedes.
You know, David, I have heard many things that have made me go, sweet, whatever, but that is absolutely horrendous. I mean, a lot of people would have gone, that's it, I'm getting out of business. I'm just going to, I've done my money. But you keep going. I mean, you kept, I mean, obviously not back to Syria, but, you said again, you thought, right, if I can survive this, I can survive anything.
Yeah, that was, for me, a turning point, which... You know, I call in the book Der Wendepunkt, the German turning point in a novel when it changes, you know, and you start thinking, oh, that for me was the turning point and was a good point for me to get on out of. I got out of the coal business because the coal business got out of itself in the UK and then moved on.
And it takes you all over them. It takes you to, you know, Africa, the Falklands. I mean, what are you doing in the Falklands? Were you penguin harvesting or something? Or what was going on there?
Well, we got a public company, got control of a public company, and we made a bid for and won Colite, the big Derbyshire manufacturer of smokeless fuels, and they had a subsidiary. The Falkland Islands Company, they bought it, I think, probably with a bit of government pressure some years before, but it was a coal bunkering station for vessels sailing between South America and Europe and Africa. And that was one of the businesses that Colite was in. It was almost a legacy business, but I mean, I went out to the Falkland Islands a couple of times.
Right.
You have to go via RAF transport plane from Bryce Norton, and that's an experience.
I can imagine. Yeah, Ascension Island must look particularly pleasant this time of year. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. but we sold the mainland onto the government.
However, this is where my little ears picked up, because the listeners can't see this. So I happen to notice quite a few trophies behind you, to put it mildly. And you get involved in the mercurial world of motor racing. Now, there's two things on this, because obviously, as the listeners will know, I am a complete motor racing nut. And so how did you, always being interested in motors, and so therefore, did you always have an interest in the noble sport of sports cars, basically?
Yes, it's been, I mean, I'm in a simple word, I'm a petrol head. And at school, at Giggleswick, I was there until 1965.
Right.
The picture on my wall was of Eric Broadley's Lola 70.
Ooh.
The one before the Lola 70, yes. Which became the GT40.
Which is a brilliant.
And yeah, I was a... Yeah. And I had pictures of the GT40 as well. I just love them. And Formula One cars, you know. But I never had any money or anything to do anything. And then during the 70s, when I was making quite a lot of money, I had the money but not the time, because I was absolutely dedicated to the business. And when the time came, there was a GT40 came up for sale, in early 70s, and I paid £65,000 for it.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And I remember people saying at the time, oh, McElhaney's blown his head off this time. That's a ridiculously high price, which, I mean, I think it probably was a bit high at the time. But I did all sorts of stuff with the car then. I won the Tour de France with it.
Yeah.
I raced at Goodwood with it.
Who did you buy it from, by the way? Because I'm interested. Who did you buy it from?
Oh, now, I bought it from Michael Wheatley.
Right.
Michael was quite a good amateur racer himself, and he'd had an accident in the car where he'd come, I think it was Woodcut at Silverstone, yeah. He'd come round the corner and the car, it was easy to get the gears wrong on it with that gear change on the right-hand side, and I think he went from fourth to third instead of fourth to fifth.
That'll do it.
Transaxle locked up, and that was it. But Michael's son, Jonathan Wheatley, who was Red Bull's competition director, yep. And then moved to Audi and has now left and waiting to do something else. I spoke to Jonathan about it because I had the car for 50 years before I sold it.
Right.
And I sold it because, you know, I was doing my times round Donington and round Silverstone and round Paul Ricard in France. And I was just 2 seconds off my time. And I thought, I'm going to have a prang if I carry on doing this.
I mean, it's a brutal machine. I mean, those who don't know, if you've seen Ford versus Ferrari or Le Mans 66, whatever, that is a GT40. And it is a brutal car, isn't it? I mean, it's a wonderful car, but it's not, you know, no driving aids on that one. And the noise itself must shake the fillings out of your teeth, David.
Oh, well, it was the most wonderful experience. I don't know how many races I did. Thousands of miles. Absolutely loved it.
And bright yellow.
Yeah, that was Michael Wheatley painted it bright yellow. It was originally white, but he painted it white yellow and I kept it because he was a big fan of Mario Andretti.
Fair enough. So what's the, we mentioned before, so how was it, what was the spark then? What was the chispa, as we call it in Spain, for you to, how did you find the time to put it all down, I suppose, David?
Well, I found the time to put it down because sort of, time found me, so to speak, because I'd sold most of the businesses I live in Switzerland. I've been there, in Switzerland here for 30-odd years. And I sold most of my oil operations probably 5-6 years ago and went from 2,500 employees to none. So there I was with, you know, time on my hands, a few bob in the bank to be able to sort of say, you know, I can just do investing now, which is what I do. And the kids were on to me again. Go on, get this book written. So there we are. I found the time. And so I started it. I had someone to help me.
Right.
Simon Elliott, Dr. Simon Elliott, who is an ex-city guy, but is famous as a Roman archaeologist now with a PhD. And he's regularly on radio and doing lectures and stuff and out to Pompeii. And he's a wonderful chap. But the thing I had trouble with the book was not so much the writing it, but the structuring of it. You know, with so many things going on together.
Yeah.
You know, coal, plant dealing, motor racing, oil and gas operations in different parts of the world, Canada and the US, in the Middle East. Russia, we were in Russia for a while, an oil trading operation. I thought, and a car retail business as well. We had quite a big car retail operation. And I thought, how can I write a book and get all this structure right when these things are happening at the same time? And Simon sorted that for me. And I mean, he did a great job. He did a fantastic job. Simon Elliott, his name is.
So what are you hoping that people will learn? I mean, because from this book, I mean, and the Americans say, if I was a big American, they'd say, you know, what do you want people to take from your journey, David? So, but what do you want people to learn from this book or take from this book, apart from it's a great read?
No, I mean, to use the regular word these days, the journey. The journey might be quite a decent read for people. It was done without any notes. I never kept a diary, so it all came from memory, and I'd be driving along the road and suddenly think, oh, God, what about that?
Yeah.
So I'd switch recording on the phone. And just a couple of words in just to remind me, and then I'll pick it up later. But I think it might be useful to want to be entrepreneurs, because, you know, I give these sort of three rules at the end. And I give one or two people who have absolutely inspired me over the years, some of whom I know, some I don't. And the three rules are to absolutely, first of all, thoroughly research what you want to do, whether it's mining, whether it's Silicon Valley products, or whether it's starting a radio station or whatever it is. And that research must include how you're going to do it and who your opposition is going to be and what are they going to do to try and stop you. Can you find a niche? That's the first thing.
Right.
And then the second thing is get your loved ones on side, because you're going to be on a 24/7 job. And if the pace is not going to be coped with by your nearest and dearest, that's going to land you with some pain. And then the last thing is absolute total dedication. Get into it and stick with it. That's where the Street Fighter comes in. And at the end of it all, with a bit of luck, you come out with a bit of money.
And I couldn't, now I've got to say to you, because you were talking about caterpillar, and no mention of JCB. And as we said off air, I've got a connection to JCB because of my godfather. But I'm good to know you actually give him a name check as well.
Yes. I mean, Anthony Bamford, Lord Bamford as he is now, when I first met him, he was Anthony Bamford.
Yeah.
But I used a lot of JCB products, but they were at the smaller end of what we were doing then. I mean, they're much bigger now. You know, it's a different business now. But the people that I put in the book that I sort of, the small number of people, I think there are about five, maybe six of them.
Yeah.
Anthony Bamford is one of them, because he inherited a business, a lot of money behind it, and he could have turned within a couple of years and sold that business to Caterpillar or Marubeni Komatsu. He didn't. You know, he didn't. He got stuck into it, kept refreshing the product on a regular basis, and look what's created now with the JCB empire. I mean, the UK really, they've looked after him in the sense that, you know, they've, you know, he's a member of the House of Lords, and by Jove, does he deserve that. But I don't know how many employees he's got in the UK, but he does the UK the most enormous amount of good. And, of course, he's a petrol head. So, you know, I quite like the fact that he's got a wonderful car collection.
Yeah, absolutely. If people want to find you online, do you have a website? Can people find you online?
No, I don't have a website. I've never had one, because I live a life of blissful anonymity. But the book's available on Amazon and on Troubadour, the publisher Troubadour. And I know that I've got friends in America who managed to buy it on Amazon. So,
well, also they can order it, because we have a virtual bookstore, and they just click on the front cover, and Amazon or a well-known distribution service will be winging its way to. So they've got to click on the cover of the book, listeners, and it will get its way to you. The book is called Street Fighter. David, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Giles, thank you very much indeed for having me. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.